Greetings, friends. I'm Wayne Tucker, and this is the Newfound Records Radio Hour. He was born in 1943 in the tiny fishing village of Rose Blanche on the rugged southwest coast of Newfoundland. His father fished, but it wasn't the sound of the wind and the waves that called young Lou Skinner. He was called by the sounds of the accordion, squeezed by his grandmother and his mother, and by the guitars that cowboys strummed in Western movies. And when Lou's family resettled to urban Portobasque, he tuned his radio first to country music and later to rock and roll. Soon, Lou Skinner was surrounded by guitars, amplifiers, and like-minded rocking friends. They formed a band and recorded Newfoundland and Labrador's first rock and roll single. Before long, the Ducats rocked the capital city, St. John's. They toured the province and the eastern seaboard. Personnel changed, times changed, their music changed, but the band adapted and survived through 5 decades. And the one common thread, the backbone, the heartbeat of the Ducats since day one, was and is Lou Skinner. He and the group have been honored by both the East Coast Music Association and Music NL. Today, on the Newfound Records Radio Hour, part one of Louis Butch Skinner, his words, his music, his story. To start, we roll back the clock to the late 1940s in isolated Rose Blanche. Lou Skinner's connection with the outside world was the coastal boat, which delivered supplies, mail, and news. But the most important cargo to young Lou and his chums was the ice cream. They ran to the store after the boat docked to get it before it melted. You see, there was no refrigeration in Rose Blanche. No electricity, no record player, no records. But there was music. The resourceful people of Rose Blanche made their own music in the 1940s. Lou now speaks of his earliest musical influences.
Born in Rose Blanche in 1943, and let's say about 1950, I took an interest in the accordion, probably about 10 years old, between 7 and 10 years old. Mom had an accordion and she could play, and my grandmother played a little bit. And I enjoyed going out on the stip in Rose Blanche playing accordion because people would notice it, and every once in a while somebody would clap for me if I did something half decent. Yeah, there was no guitars in Rose Blanche that I can recall. Never had no interest in it anyway. Didn't know if it fit to eat, but the accordion was a big deal at that time.
Right. So do you recall anybody actually teaching you to play it? How did you learn?
I just learned by listening to somebody else, like I do today. And play by ear, right?
What kind of music were you playing then?
Just traditional stuff. I was boys and... In Rose Blanche for entertainment, there'd be a dance or something at the association hall. Everybody got there for a get-together about once a month, I guess, say. And they had two or three accordion players would show up, and there was another man, like I say, showed up with a fiddle. But no guitar, no rhythm, but just the fiddle and accordion. That was it. That was as good as it got.
And feet.
Eh? And feet. The feet going, yes, absolutely, yeah. Maybe. But we did have one man... Huey Vellis, Mr. Huey Vellis used to come down on the coastal boat, and he had a cowboy guitar, you know, one of those guitars with a picture of a cowboy on a horse on it, and they had a Potbelly Stove and Association on, and he would stand up on the side of the stove and play guitar and sing. Well, that never happened very often, but that was a big thrill, that was, and that would have been about 1949, 1950. He's from down around the Grand Bank area. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's still living. He's still playing a bit of guitar. And he was a hero. He was like a folk hero, like Omer Blondell became a folk hero. You know, he was traveling.
He was traveling.
Yeah, he would go all over the island, do all the outports, put a cover charge on the door. And
now, did you remember at that point in time, you said he was playing guitar?
Yeah.
Did anything click with you then that I want to learn how to play that instrument? Because you were used to accordion, I presume.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Right.
That sort of intrigued me, the fact that he had a guitar, because once in a while you go to see a old Western movie and somebody would break out with a guitar and start singing. So that sort of helped reflect that, you know.
Right. Okay. So aside then from the influences of your mother and grandmother and the people like Vallis, you are also influenced by the movies.
Yes.
Tell me more about that. Where would you go to watch movies, and what did you like to?
Well, at the Association Hall, I think it was there. Somebody would break out a projector, and they used to have the. I remember the movies used to come in the big round metal cans, and it would be like Apollon Cassidy or Roy Rogers and Cisco Kid and all that stuff. But it seemed like in the middle of and Gene Autry, of course, seemed like in the middle of the movie somewhere, somebody would break out a guitar and start singing cowboy songs, right?
Moping along on the horse.
Yes, right, all that stuff, yes, yeah.
Around the campfire.
Even the horse would walk on beat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So, so that influenced you, I suppose, that part of the singing cowboy and playing guitar. They weren't playing accordions, were they?
No. They weren't playing accordions in Hollywood.
When Lou was partway through grade 4, his family resettled from rural Rose Blanche to urban Port-au-Basque. Now there his father could work with the railway, and he could fish as well. New doors opened to Lou there, new opportunities in this town with electricity, radios, and guitars. He listened intently to radio, especially to Wheeling, West Virginia, when the signal came through loud and clear in the nighttime. He heard wonderful country music, including bluegrass, outstanding musicians playing their instruments with great skill and speed, and young Lou was smitten. In 1953, when Lou was 10 years old, his mother ordered his first guitar from the only source available in Port-au-Basque, the Eaton's catalog. It was a cowboy guitar called Campfire. Lou tried to play it, but something was wrong. Then he realized he had a right-handed guitar. Now Lou is left-handed, and to play a right-handed guitar, well, he could have turned the strings upside down, but he didn't think about doing that, and instead he turned the whole guitar upside down, which meant the strings would be strummed in reversed order, and it also meant that the fingering for chords was upside down, too. Now, you know, it's challenging to learn to play a guitar right side up, but to learn to play it upside down with no instruction, well, that's almost unthinkable. Yet, young Lou was determined. Nothing would stop him, and so he learned to play his cowboy campfire guitar upside down. Now, by the time Lou got his second guitar, a Harmony Stellar, he had figured out it would be easier to play if he just turned the strings over. And when he did that, everything fell into place, everything worked better. Up until 1957, Lou had been content with his acoustic guitars. But in that year, three events stimulated Lou's interest in electric guitars. Here's Lou.
Well, there was a group of buddies. They were probably like 5 or 6, 7 years older than us. They got together. They were called the Hillbilly Jewels. And they did what was called hillbilly music at the time, but really it was country and western. So we used to listen to these guys and learn things.
What's the timing of this now? How old are
we're,
you now?
We're into like 56, 57.
Yes.
So, you know, we'll get into that. So they used to do that, and there was another fellow who had the Gibson guitar. He used to go around, and he used to pick Hank Snow stuff. Oh, my. He could really do it. He had that sound. And we were amazed with that, and I learned a bit of that. I stole a lot of licks from Cease Allen, his name was. But I think a couple of big impacts happened in 57, two or three actually, that really locked up the guitar thing for me. There was a friend of ours who became our first singer, Joe Willis in Port au Basque. Joe had an Harmony Roy Smith guitar. I guess the guitar players would know what I'm talking about. It was a black guitar, and it had the binding around the hinges were aluminum, like you see on the old-fashioned tables, chrome sits.
Yes.
And Joe used to stand outside of a restaurant in Port au Basque, Mrs. Petite's restaurant, and lean up against the door there or whatever and start singing Ginny, Gin, Gin. He was doing all Elvis and Little Richard. And myself and Jim Crew was just there on the street like everybody else listening. My God, the guitar is so loud. He's singing Little Richard. He's singing Elvis. Listen to this. Oh, my God, right? That was that. And then a few nights later, on comes Johnny Cash with I Walk the Line. The guitar work and that all that bass string stuff, that was intriguing. Oh, my God. So consequently, myself and Jim at that time had our guitars hung up on the wall. We had this knack of hanging the guitar on the wall and just look at it. It felt good just looking at it, you know. And Jim and I still do that. There's one in my dining room, and Jim got one in his kitchen, I believe. It's just hanging there. The idea that we sit down, and when he looks at the guitar, you start reminiscing of all the stuff we've done and where we've been and all that. So between Johnny Cash and Joe Willis, and then out comes Elvis. And, of course, I became a big Scotty Moore fan real fast. Couldn't figure out how in the hell one guitar player was making all that noise and all that sound. But he had a little bit of a Chet Atkins thing going with his guitar work, and he had a delay pedal hooked up. And, he's only a guitar, bass, and drums. Elvis was playing a bit of rhythm. Well, you couldn't hear that much on the records, right? And that really cooked it then, you know, between Johnny Cash and the local guys and Elvis coming on the scene and all that guitar music. And, oh.
Where were you hearing this?
On the radio.
On the radio.
Yeah, on the radio.
So when you heard Scotty Moore, was this tuning you in for the first time that you could get different sounds out of the guitar than you were used to?
Yeah. They had this thing called electric guitar. They had pickups on it. And that was fine, right? And I told Mom I wanted an electric guitar. A friend of ours in Port au Basque had one for sale for $40, K guitar. And I said, I wanted that, you know. And she said, well, I don't know if we're going to do it. Your father's going to go off to his. He's getting another guitar here. And she said, well, I'll arrange something. So anyway, she gave me the $40. I wore about the guitar. So when I went home, Mom said, plug her in. I said, what do you mean, plug her in? I got no amplifier. She said, don't it plug in the wall? I said, no, don't plug. Oh, my God. She said, I can't tell your father you've got to buy an amplifier. My God, you never said that. I thought you just plug it in the wall. You said it with an electric guitar. So that didn't go over too
makes
good.
Sense.
So me and Jim Crew decided that we'd buy an amp between us. The amplifier was $49. Three inputs and an 8-inch speaker. That's what we started off with. Yeah. So that between the Johnny Cash stuff and the local guys and Elvis and all that, we end up with our first electric guitars. And we're going to do wonders, right?
Time for a short break, and when Newfound Records returns, the Duquettes become regional rock and roll stars.
Featuring the best in folk and blues, you're tuned to Mun Radio 93.5 CHMR FM, your only music alternative.
Some like it hot, some like it on the rocks. Me, I like it fair. Fair trade coffee means that farmers improve their living conditions while respecting the environment, and it tastes really good. For a decent cup of coffee, look for the Transfair logo. It's your guarantee that the coffee growers were paid a fair price and that the environment is protected. For more information, call 514-522-2000 or 1-888-663-3247. This message has been brought to you by Équiterre with the support of the Canadian International Development Agency.
I'm Wayne Tucker, and you're listening to the Newfound Records Radio Hour. Today, part one of the Lou Skinner story, The Man and His Music. In 1958, 74 coal miners died in the town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia. Lou Skinner and Jim Crew wanted to contribute money to a disaster relief fund. How to do it? So they put a band together to play in a benefit concert at the elementary school in Port au Basque. Joe Willis, Cease Allen, and others joined with Lou and Jim, and this was Lou's first public performance, and they helped raise a lot of money. Now, this success was a revolution to Lou and Jim. They thought, this is pretty good. All these people paid money to hear us play. So they formed a rock and roll band, at first calling themselves the Three Teens, then the Four Teens, then the Five Teens, depending on how many band members there were for a gig. Now, after a while, they decided the band needed a permanent name. So at Lou's suggestion, they named themselves after a box of candy, the Ducats. The Ducats played teenage dances at venues like the Orange Lodge and the Chick Dick Lodge in the Caudvoy Valley. Eventually, Joe Willis left the group and was replaced by vocalist Winston Blackmore. Art Bragg played drums and Bob Battis bass. They landed alone, bought some gear, and Lou learned to play the mandolin, a right-handed mandolin. Now, a mandolin is 8 strings, so it was definitely too much trouble to change all those around, and in keeping with custom, Lou learned to play it upside down, and he actually can't play a left-handed mandolin even today. In the early 1960s, Lou left his band for a year or so to play in the Stephenville area, where even the Cats and Dogs were good musicians. The Shindigs were a popular group there. Charlie Martin, Ronnie Alexander, Jerry Fromanger, Harry Cormier, Roddy LaPrière, and others. But Lou played with Jimmy O'Quinn's band, Jimmy B and the Bops. They played Cornerbrook and the University of Antigonish, as well as Stephenville. But Porta Basque missed Lou. He had been the leader of the local band there, and when he left, there was no one to play the dances. So Lou returned home, and the Ducats rocked on. By 1964, the Ducats were ready to take their music to another level. Lou Skinner explains.
In 64, we decided we should write our own tunes. I don't know for sure, but they say we're probably one of the first groups in Eastern Canada, at least, to write our own material and record it. Yeah. And so we wrote a few tunes, 5 tunes, actually. And we said, well, what are we going to do with them? And we had a friend of ours down in around Bangor, Maine, down around Lynn, Massachusetts. And he had relatives in Porta Basque, and he had already heard the band. So we made arrangements to call him, and he made arrangements to call the studio in Boston, Boylston Street Studios, I think it was called. So we called them and asked them, could we come down and do a record? So they said yes, but before you do, you had to give us a written list of the equipment you got. So we sent down a list in detail of what gear we were bringing. And they came back and said, yes, okay, that sounds fine. Sounds like you know what you're doing. So we packed everything we had, except the PA system, into 2 cars. And we drove to Boston from Porta Basque just to record 2 songs. And now everybody goes down to their basement and do that, right?
It's incredible. It's incredible to change.
So we recorded 5 songs, but 2 they chose for us and said, this is the best ones, you know. And we agreed. And we put them out on the record and got a lot of PR from that. We never made no money on it, but we got a lot of PR. Got us a little bit of airplay. We got airplay in Boston. We got airplay in Toronto, Montreal. We got airplay in Halifax and down, especially through Nova Scotia. When we were into Boston recording, the guys on the studio was called the Yakis Brothers. Years later, I went somewhere and I bought a record. John Lennon, the rock and roll album was called.
Yes.
And if you turn over on the back of it, producer, Shelley Yakis. That's where John Lennon went. Either he went there to do that one, or if that was closed, obviously he did it in a studio probably in New York. Mm-hmm. And Shelley Yakis was his producer. So we were, without knowing it, without planning it, we were intermixing with some of the good people anyway.
The best.
Yeah.
The best that there were.
Hey, woman, you really do things to me. Hey, woman, hey, woman, why don't you let me be?
1964, Lou Skinner, Art Bragg, Jim Crew, Bob Battis, and Winston Blackmore, the Ducats, Hey Woman. Now, following the success of their first single, the Ducats began to think about recording a full long-playing album. Once again, here's Lou Skinner.
Yeah, that's after the Boston record, yeah.
Yes.
And then we said, well, this thing's been going good, so why don't we get in touch with a studio in Toronto or Montreal and do an LP? Got to be some money in that. We get good PR because we have a picture on a cover. So we got in touch with RCA Studios, and we went there and paid the shot, did the record, and they said, well, we like what we're hearing, so if you want to, we'll release it for you. And I remember first thing I said, that mean we get our money back? They said, no, you got to pay for the session, but you'll get a little more money on royalties, on sales, doing it that way. I said, okay, good. So we all agreed, because everything we did, we all had to say yes or no to it, right, as a team. And so RCA put the record out.
This was the album.
Put the album out, yeah. And at that time, the big idea we had in Porter Bass was, if we're going to do anything with this, let's put the image there, too. And that's where the Newfoundland Tartan Jackets came in. We had a local clothing store, took an interest in us, and the manager measured us all up and had the Newfoundland Tartan Jackets come in. So I said, no, we'll look the part on stage, and we'll look the part on the record cover, you know. And that was always a big out. People still refer to it as the Tartan LP, yep, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So that works. And they did like us. They did like us in the studio. Because we were nervous, so because we were a bit nervous, we were easy to get along with. And then they said, the next day we went there, we listened to the playback and made a couple little changes. And the president of RCA said, I want you to take you over to meet a friend of mine today. We went over to the Royal York Hotel, and there was the band leader for the Royal York Hotel. His name was Moxie Whitney. And he said, this is Moxie Whitney, he's the orchestra leader for here. No harm intended, but we send him over a couple of your songs, and he's very excited. So we went in his office, and he put the tape on. It was on tape. And he played, and he said, I like this. He said, I really like this. He said, I think we can do something with it. First thing he said, well, like, what do you mean, do something with it? We're not going to go back to the studio no more. He said, no. He said, I can take a section from the orchestra down there, downstairs, and put it behind you guys and have a few shows. Maybe we can work a recording contract in a different way. Oh. What did that mean? Well, you're going to have to go on tour. Like, you're either going to work at your jobs in Porter Bass or you're going to have to leave and go on tour. Because if we're going to promote you, we can't promote you without having you. We said, well, can we think on this? Yeah, so we got out in the car in the van we had, and we started talking. And our attitude was, what are they up to? What are they trying to do? Here we are, going to get signed up with RCA Records. We've got this other guy over in the hotel. He's probably a great musician, but what's he after? No? This means we're going to be eat up by the business end of the whole thing, and pretty soon somebody's going to get all tormented and take off back home.
Sounds like you didn't have a manager.
Well, we said that in later years, that we would have done better if we just stick to the instruments, let somebody else do the paperwork and the bookings. And everywhere they send us, say yes, and go. There was a lot of good plans in the works for the band. There really was.
But you were breaking new ground. I mean, the business of music was completely new to you. You didn't
We didn't have
realize
two clues.
We didn't have two clues,
but the business end of the music business.
Yeah.
That's simple as that. We could play the instruments and create a good rock and roll beat, and we were a good dance band, so they say, and we should have had somebody that would have controlled us.
But you didn't know it at the time.
No, we didn't know. We didn't know the difference.
You did the best you could with what you had.
Yeah. You know, like, everything was an ordeal to us.
Sure, because there was no precedent in Newfoundland. There was no other band that had gone before you.
No.
And had learned, and you could learn from their mistakes. You were the ones that were making the mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah, right, yeah.
and it was not all mistakes. You did a lot of things right.
Yeah, we did some things right. I hope.
The Tartan album, also released as a single. The Do-Cats, with the song that got the most airplay from that album, was a hit for the Rolling Stones, written by the Rolling Stones, Off the Hook. Well, it's time now for Newfound Records. Take a little breather, but stay right where you are. We'll be right back with the conclusion of part one of the Lou Skinner story.
Join me on Sundays at 1 p.m. for Jig's Dinner, all your best Newfoundland, Irish and Celtic music right here on 93.5 FM.
Featuring the best in folk and blues, you're tuned to Mun Radio 93.5 CHMR FM, your only music alternative.
I'm David Suzuki. You're either on the bus or off the bus. If you're on the bus, 40 vehicles are off the road. One busload of commuters keeps 70,000 liters of gasoline from being burned. That keeps 9 tons of pollution out of the air. And it puts $5,000 into the pocket of every person on the bus. Get on the bus and breathe easier. The future is in your hands.
Don't drive the planet to destruction. Get around smarter at davidsuzuki.org.
I'm Wayne Tucker. And you're listening to the Newfound Records Radio Hour, where today we're profiling the life and times of legendary rock and roll guitarist Lou Skinner. Now, the Do-Cats album was a huge local hit in 1966, and it helped establish the Do-Cats as local stars. they traveled to the big city of St. John's for the first time, where they played at Memorial University's Winter Carnival, and they played on the Art Andrews Dance Party TV show. And that show was the Newfoundland equivalent of Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Here's Lou Skinner. In 1966, Come Home Here, you made your first trip to St. John's and played here at the university. Talk to me about that.
What was that? The university?
The Winter Carnival.
Winter Carnival. Hmm. The boys, part of the same crew after later years at artists to go to Halifax to play, they were all on that same fraternity thing, right? They brought us in here and to play. And we said, okay, lovely, that sounds good. Go to St. John's, play. I'll promote the record too, right? We played, the first place we played in there was CLB Amory. They said, we'll do a teenage dance first and give you a chance to warm up. So we went down to CLB Amory, and to us, my God, it was like a stadium. What a big building, right? Like, I don't know. So we went down there and we played that night, and it was block solid. So this is good. The next night we went in the dining hall and played. And where the dining hall, the way it was laid out, out where they had a bandstand, we had all windows behind us, a whole slew of windows. And we were getting ready to play, and we looked out, and there's a lineup of people. And we got closer to the window and looked down the side of the building, and the lineup went on and on and on. And our singer said, where are they going? I said, you bloody fool, they're coming to hear this. Oh, my God. He said, I can't sing in front of all them. I said, well, you're going to have to, because I can't.
That was at the university, in the dining hall at the university.
Yeah, dining hall at university. Yeah. It was block solid. And then the boys said, listen, there's a club here in town that wants you to play down at Churchill Square, Park Lounge, I think it was called at the time. Became the Circle after. So we went down there and played. One night show. And then we all thought of it, looked at each other and said, my God, we better go home. We're working. Well, what are we going to do? We got to go. And they said, no, you don't go home. We got another 3 nights booked for you. So we get a bit of chance to make a bit of our expenses back for bringing you down here. And you guys get a whole lot of money for yourself. So we all got on the phone and called our bosses. Never had a problem. I remember Mr. Buchamp. I asked for him personally. So he said, how are you doing with it? I said, pretty good. The band is really being accepted. I said, you know, really good. Getting good crowds. I said, crowds, they can't handle the crowds. A lot of people can't get in. Well, he said, as long as you're doing that much, he said, don't you come home. Don't you worry about the job. That'll always be here.
Well, that must have meant a lot to you.
To me, it meant a lot. So we stayed an extra couple, 3 nights. It was very, very good. We had good crowds. We got to a point where we didn't want to go home, but like we said, well, we got to go home and kind of work, number one. Number two, we're going to burn ourselves out. After a while, we're just going to be just another local band anyway. So we did that.
After the Tartan album, the band decided to record another single to keep their name out there, to get some airplay and to help with bookings. Once again, Lou Skinner.
When we were in Portobas, after the record, the RCA thing was out and we were doing the road thing, we thought, well, we better do another record. Now, even if it didn't sell, if we got some airplay, it'd keep the name out front, right? So we wrote them two tunes, Waiting and Sneezes, with the idea that it's good enough for airplay, probably, then it's a help for us for our bookings, you know?
Yes.
That was a cute thing because somebody had to do the Sneezes part, and I got chosen to do that. And I think I've had the flu ever since. and on Waiting, it was a pretty tune, if I say so myself. And we thought we should have a 12-string guitar on it. So the only 12-string guitar, I had a Biltone. 12-string guitar is not a favorite thing of mine. So I bought a Biltone for $50 or something. But Jim Crew had an electric Fender 12-string. Because every time I suggest something to Jim that would improve the rhythm section of the band, he'd go buy it. Now, whether it improved the rhythm section or not, I didn't care. I just wanted to have the instrument around, right?
Yes.
So we took this Fender 12-string, and they said, well, if you're going to do a lead part on it, an intro, an ending, what are you going to do? I said, I'll play it upside down. I ain't changing 12 strings over. At all rate, I'm not in no mood, and I'll change strings over on a ukulele, let alone 12 strings. So that's what we did. I played Jim Cruise Fender solid body 12 string, very rare item.
Played upside down.
And played upside down, very rare item.
On the song Waiting, yes.
Yeah.
Waiting by the Dukettes. And that's Lewis Skinner playing Jim Carew's very rare Fender solid body 12 string upside down. Now, by late 1966, the band members had made a difficult decision. They quit their day jobs and became full-time musicians. With that meant touring, lots of it. So they made the prestigious Old Mill nightclub in St. John's their home base. Now, at that time, the Old Mill was one of the top venues in the capital city. You had to be one of the best to take the stage there. The club's manager, Scott Mercer, took a keen interest in the group. He even helped them get bookings on the mainland. Their tour circuit in the late 1960s included gigs across the island from the Old Mill in St. John's to Port-au-Basque and then returned to their home base. Then they were off and off to Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and occasionally New Brunswick and Boston. On one of their trips to Boston, the Dukettes rubbed shoulders with Johnny and the Hurricanes, rock and rollers who had a top 10 hit with Red River Rock. Another occasion, they performed the song Green Tambourine, a number one hit for the Lemon Pipers in 1968. The group's manager was in the audience, and he told the boys that they performed the song better than the Lemon Pipers did. Also in Boston, the Dukettes met Ernie Ginsberg, one of Beantown's top DJs. Ernie hosted a nightly rock and roll show in the mid-1960s. One evening, the Dukettes showed up at the WMEX radio studio and asked if they could talk to Ernie. He agreed to see them, liked what he heard, and whisked them into the studio for an impromptu interview. During gigs in Montreal, Lou and the boys were invited backstage to hang with one of their idols, legendary rock and roller Bill Haley of Rock Around the Clock fame. That's when Lou got an opportunity to play Bill Haley's guitar. Upside down, of course. Now, also in Montreal, they met another idol, Little Richard during a stint at the Scandinavian Club. Meanwhile, back in St. John's, the Ducats were sharing the stage with superstars like the Turtles and the Stampeders. The Ducats were having a ball. They were regional stars. In the late 1960s, they landed a gig at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, and this led to their first appearance on Canadian national television, CBC's Where It's At, hosted by the legendary Frank Cameron. Now, by the late 1960s, the changing times were reflected in popular music. The Ducats, too, began to experiment with psychedelic and progressive rock music. And on Where It's At, they performed songs like Hey Jude and Revolution by the Beatles and Fire by Jimi Hendrix. Surprisingly, on drums for this major gig was a rookie drummer in his mid-teens who was playing with the group for his first time. That was Lou Skinner's brother, Roger. He was recruited as a last-minute replacement when the band's regular drummer suddenly quit, and Roger went on to become a fixture with the group. Now, by the late 60s and the early 70s in Newfoundland, show bands were becoming popular. Acts such as the Carlton Show Band, the Caribou Show Band, the Newfoundland Show Band, and the Ocean Show Band in Port-au-Basque often mixed a diversity of musical genres with comedy to entertain their audiences. When Claude Keynes became the Ducats' vocalist, he brought a natural flair for comedy with him. Here's Lou Skinner.
There was another case of marketing, I suppose you call it. In old rock and roll, we did it, and now you got the Ariev show band and this show band, that show band. So we said, well, all they're doing really is playing some rock and roll, and they're playing a lot of country and traditional stuff. So if that means getting bookings, we'll do it. Because one thing about Claude Keynes, he was a good front man, good musician. It didn't matter what kind of venue we picked to do. He could do it anyway. So that's what we did.
So you, for that recording, at least, you had abandoned rock and roll entirely. There was no rock and roll on that.
No.
There's like country on one side and the traditional stuff on the, on the other, essentially.
And that's the record that the... our friend Dutchie Mason played piano for us. And that was done at a high school auditorium in Halifax.
Tell me, how did you get Dutchie Mason involved?
Well, he had a good profile there in Halifax, and he came over when we were playing here in St. John's. And that he came over a couple of times playing because he was doing all the blues stuff, but we liked him as a piano player. He was a good country, bluesy piano player. And we became good friends, like carrying on a lot and all that. So when we got in Halifax, we called him and said, we're up at the school auditorium, we're doing a record, you want to come and play piano for us? And he said, oh my God, yes, sure. So he came up and did that. And we did some country tunes, anybody going to San Antone and a few more and a bunch of accordion stuff. And now there's a tidbit piece of information. You're giving me credit for playing the right-handed guitar upside down. Claude Keynes played my guitar upside down for that recording session.
A left-handed guitar.
Yeah, I had a left-handed Martin. Oh,
so he could do it too.
Yeah, and he also learned because I had nice guitars, and when you're on the road, acoustic guitar was more important than anything else, and I was the only one carrying around an acoustic guitar. And Claude learned to play upside down in order to get at it. You know, so to speak. Right. So that day we did a session. I played electric guitar, and the rest of the boys played their instruments, and Claude played my guitar, my Martin guitar, upside down.
That goes in my mind.
And it gives a pretty good sound when you think about it, because he's hitting the small string first with his down sweep, right? Mm. And it's almost like a 12 string in a way, because you're not airing a big string up, you're airing a small string down to the big string. Yeah. And it gave us a different sound.
You got to learn a completely different fingering for your chords. Oh, no. For that?
Chords? Everything's upside down.
Yeah.
Talking about that, talking about that album, all the stuff I learned in Road Place, that's what I played on that record.
Oh, the
accordion stuff.
Oh, and the accordion, yes. Yeah. Yes, I didn't, yes, because you are playing the accordion. Almost one side is on.
Yeah.
A full one side is accordion on that, I think.
Yeah.
Just about, yeah.
From the 1971 album, Ducats Show Band. The Ducats, in country mode, with the Hank Williams composition, You Win Again, and after that, a traditional tune of the type which Lou learned on the accordion as a young boy in Rose Blanche. Ducat Show Band. Now, in the early 1970s, the intensive touring schedule of the Ducats wound down. Lou needed a day job, so he opened a music store in downtown St. John's. Here's Lou.
Well, around December 71, I opened up the first music store, a little small place down at Water Street East. And I got my own building about the middle section of Water Street, around 74. And we had that going for about 10 years, and we were doing pretty good. We had all the main brand names that you want, and somebody wanted something. I was lucky enough, being in the business long enough, I knew what they were talking about, what the problem was, and I knew exactly who to phone to get whatever they wanted. But where we ran into a problem was we had a nice-sized music store, and we were blocked with inventory. We had a lot of inventory. You had to have it. But in comes this thing called disco music, which didn't need bands. In comes the breathalyzer. In comes Roadblox. So overnight, a five-piece band became a single act, the singer and his guitar. So you take that and spread it over the spectrum of St. John's, like was within a month, there was probably 40 bands disappeared. Couldn't get to work. In comes electronic drummers. I wouldn't sell them down music center. Electronic drummers, because you don't have to hire a drummer. So that's one guy you don't have to play. Yeah. But the damn things are only like tic-tac, tic-tac. I mean, it's terrible. Today now, they got some pretty good quality stuff, but I still would never want to be on stage with an electronic drummer if I can help it.
Yes.
So between the electronic drummer and the breathalyzer and the disco music, it weeded all the customers down. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't only my music store felt that pinch. But I got caught with a lot of inventory, Gibsons and Martins and you name it, right? Mm-hmm. So we never had no choice. We just sold off and closed down.
But didn't I say a music store would have been later than that, I would have thought, up in the Zellers Mall or Torbay Road, that area that you had?
Yeah, that was sort of a transition period. I missed the store. I missed the musicians coming in and talking. And, you know, I didn't care if anybody bought anything or not. I just liked to see the people, right? And I opened up that little place called Musicians Warehouse with the idea that what I got, which would, as you know, was very small. But what I don't have, here's a catalog. Go ahead, we'll order it. And I was bringing in stuff for people. And it was going pretty good. And a musician friend of mine came along and he wanted it. Because he was buying the record store next door. There was a record shop over there. He said, I'll buy the record shop. He said, I'm going to do that anyway. But he said, why don't I buy you out and you stay on as a manager? I said, fine. That's good with me. As long as I'm out of the house and doing something, right?
I see you did that.
Yeah.
And you ended up, I don't know if there are other places or not, but you're up at Portugal Cove Road up until a little while ago. You're not there now.
Yeah, that was a contract deal. Right. I was down with Music City, too. I had 6 months down there. That was a contract deal, just helping out and whatever needed to be done. So I had pretty good knowledge of the different the guitars and the traditional music stuff. And the other one on Portugal Cove, that was a contract deal, a management deal that expired. And in between all that, after the music store, I went into real estate. I was with Remax and Tony Murray. And Tony Murray, Century 21 Remax. I got 10 years in the real estate business.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
So that was pretty good.
Oh, away from music entirely, a whole different ballgame, yeah.
You've been listening to the Newfound Records Radio Hour. The show was recorded at the CHMR Studios, Memorial University, St. John's. Tune in next Saturday at noon for the conclusion of the Lou Skinner story. We'll hear how Lou discovered Newfoundland's only recording artist to win 2 Juno Awards, Eddie Rausel. And Lou tells us about the trip he and Eddie took to Nashville, where they recorded with Elvis Presley's guitarist and Lou's idol, Scotty Moore, and Elvis's drummer, DJ Fontana. We'll also hear how Lou coaxed Newfoundland's first lady of the accordion, Minnie White, out of the kitchen and into the recording studio. The Lou Skinner Story was researched, produced, and hosted by me, Wayne Tucker. The show airs Saturday at noon and rebroadcasts on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Thanks to Lou Skinner for the interview, which was recorded at the CHMR studio in March of 2012. Thanks for the music, Lou. Keep it coming. Until next time, as always, be kind to Mother Earth and her children, everybody. Bye-bye.